Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
I've worked with him for I don't know how many years, and I still cannot do a good Dick Staub impression. I can maybe throw out some of his phrases about living on islands and things, but I can't quite catch his voice. I have a deep voice, so that should help, but it doesn't. Hi, welcome to the Kindling's Muse, our annual, much anticipated, always beloved theology of the Academy Awards. Joining me tonight is Dr. Reverend Very Jeff Cuse, who, if you did not know, is also the star of the next Bourne Identity film. Are you not? Jeff Cuse, because...
My car exploded in ball
Where?
Fire at SeaTac Airport.
Yes.
At the departure gate on Friday the 13th.
Uh-huh.
And shut down the departure gate for 30 minutes.
Exactly. So this
yes.
summer blockbuster.
Yes.
Starring.
At the break, I'll show you pictures.
Jeff Cuse. So. It's explosive. It's
in 3D, too.
In 3D. Yeah. Yeah, watch out for that. Thank you for joining us, sir. And, of course, we have back with us again, Professor Christine Chaney. We are so glad to have you here. And you have some interesting insights on tonight's films that I'm very excited.
Yeah,
to hear.
Thank
so
you very much.
And then, go ahead.
I was just going to say I just like to be here with my two Jeff friends.
Yes, your two
kind
Jeff
of a
friends.
Chris sandwich
the
with Jeffs. The Jeffs.
Yeah, it is. The Jeffs. Sorry. For those listening at home, Chris is in between Jeff and Jeffrey.
I know, it's just leave it.
Yes.
Leave it on the table.
Mine's out of the gutter, people.
Yeah, that's right.
Come on.
Yeah, please.
You haven't even started drinking. Jeffrey Overstreet, as always, our film critic is here with us this evening.
Actually, Jeffrey Overstreet couldn't be here tonight, so I'm Meryl Streep in the role of Jeffrey Overstreet.
All right.
Nice.
So, or are you Tilda Swinton in the role?
Of the Academy Award goes to...
Yes.
That's right.
But bump-ching. Okay, we think we're funny. Okay, we do not have very much time to cover all these movies. We never do. So we're just going to go into it. We're starting with The Artist. Okay? This is the outline favorite.
Do you want to go through a list of them first and then maybe read them off?
You just like speed read all of them?
Okay.
Here we go. Everybody ready? The Artist, Hugo, War Horse, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, The Descendants, Moneyball, Tree of Life, The Help, Midnight in Paris. So we're starting with The Artist. The Artist. How many of you guys have seen that?
Clap if you've seen it.
Yeah, okay. So, potential spoiler alert on all these movies. I'm sorry, but it happens every year. We try not to do it, but it happens. So there may be a spoiler in this one as well. The Artist. It is Hollywood, 1927. George Valentine is a silent movie superstar. The advent of the talkies will sound the death knell for his career and see him fall into oblivion. For young extra Pepe Miller, it seems the sky's the limit. Major movie stardom awaits. The Artist tells the story of their interlinked destinies. A crowd-pleasing tribute to the magic of silent cinema, The Artist is a clever, joyous film with delightful performances and visual style to spare. That is from Rotten Tomatoes. And we are starting with Miss Chris.
Dr. Chaney, yes, and I'm a big fan of The Artist, not just because I think it's going to win, which is a separate commentary on just Hollywood kind of gamesmanship and all that, but to me, The Artist is fabulous, not just because it's delightful and sweet and very charismatic performers, but at some level, I think why it resonates deeper than just a sort of nostalgia, kitsch, you know, successful, silent, you know, makeover for modern times is that, in a way, I think it gets at deeper questions for artists, for men, maybe, in general, who are what they do, who are what they do and don't completely lose ethics and identity outside of being successfully their own profession. And so I think the fact that it's called The Artist is distinctive. I mean, it's easy to get facile about actors. They want to be stars. When they're not stars, they fall into a pit. And then when they're stars again, they're happy again. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly a superficial reading of this story. But I think it's a deeper commentary about a kind of even emptiness when... we as humans, especially men, I want to say, get over-identified mm-hmm. with their jobs, who they are, and in this case, as a performer. It's a very charming. I'm totally in love with the star. I hope he wins Best Actor. But I think it's deeper than that.
So you're thinking that that is why people are maybe connecting with that in a larger audience? That's why people are connecting, because they see themselves there?
Possibly. I just think it's a deeper critique, or it's a deeper question about being human than just a sort of sweet... replaying of silent film, kind of Gene Kelly tropes. I think it's a little deeper than that, and that's why I'm a fan of it in a way that some of my friends and colleagues are not as strongly in favor of it as a sort of richer film than just an exercise.
Okay. Gentlemen?
I'll give my 2 cents on it. I think that one of the reasons why, for me, there's been such an amazing outpouring of love on this film is that silence is the new loud. is that in a sea of noise and soundtracks and volume control and manipulation of emotions, and that's part of with scoring and stuff even in this film. But the idea of just watching something and not being told what it is for many Americans today is so foreign that this carries a transcendent level to it. It speaks of such a time so far back. There was a time when things were in black and white. There was a time when people just acted in this way. That nostalgia has brought us back to a place of purity and almost sublime meaning. I mean, literally the word nostalgia in the Greek is the pain of the past. That gnosis of knowledge and this idea of being pulled back, of knowing that the past is there, but I can't ever get it, is a painful memory, is what nostalgia is. And I think it evokes that. But I think that the silent movie as coming out now in this particular time, for me, felt very gimmicky. I like that it happened. I thought it was great. I mean, we have to talk about Uggy the dog, right?
Oh, so yes.
Lift your glasses to Uggy the dog tonight.
There is a dog in this movie, and he's a terrier, and he's very cute.
He's very cute.
It's completely charming. And he plays
right.
dead.
Was it Alfred Hitchcock who said never work with children or pets, right? And so you have this dog, and he's adorable, right? So you have that adorable figure. So for me, it's the false chord was that I felt like that I was being manipulated by silence in ways that other movies manipulate me by sound, or the idea of it in that way.
But it had a soundtrack, Jeff, my friend.
Well, I know. Okay, yes. Okay, true.
And manipulated, using emotion and music. So, I think I hear what you're saying about silence, but there was lots of ways that sound was cueing the story.
Right.
It wasn't utterly silent.
Right.
You get the point for using the word nostalgia first tonight, by the way. But think about this. I mean, how many of these 9 movies are about doing things the old-fashioned way? Mm-hmm. The Help. Hugo is all about Hollywood nostalgia. Midnight in Paris is explicitly about nostalgia and the dangers and benefits of nostalgia. War Horse is done in the style of 1940s movies. And then you think about other films like The Muppets, which were about going back to doing things the old-fashioned way.
There we go. Lift your glasses. Yes. I said
Muppets. The Muppets.
Every time Muppets
earlier.
Mentioned tonight,
or,
there we go.
Or Winnie the Pooh, which was done in the style of the original Winnie the Pooh cartoons back in the late 60s in the hand-drawn animation. It's like all of a sudden, Transformers 3 and 4 or whatever number we're on now is letting
us
know just
how... You're getting personal
now. It's just so easy to see amazing animated things now that we're starting to value again how much work went into those wonders back then. And so this is just, I think, sort of catching on to the trendiness of that. But I did love the email I got from somebody in Hollywood who said... This is Janet Batchelor writes, this is not only a movie about actors, but a movie in which being unemployed is the greatest calamity that can befall an actor, and in which the world is made right when an actor is once again gainfully employed. This, she says, is why it's guaranteed to win Best Picture, because most of the Academy's voters are actors. So, and to me, it was already kind of obvious because the Oscars are the big party that the Academy and Hollywood throw for themselves, and this is a movie that worships Hollywood and its traditions. So
but there is depth there. I'm sorry, honey, because there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people out of work in America today too, and I think the depth of it. I think there are shadows here that are deeper than just a sort of Hollywood love fest or even just nostalgia. Mm-hmm. I think people. I think the pain and Jean Dujardin's acting. Of the sort of just literal identity fall apart, complete and utter disintegration around unemployment. I mean, I just think, like the 1930s movies, the shadows around, you know, Busby Berkeley and Fred Astaire as well, is about a kind of fantasy that is also...
If he'd been a character that was something more than a jerk, I might have cared about him.
Yeah. But, he's an actor.
You're not all that bad. Okay, we got to move on. We got to keep going. We could spend half the show talking on the artist. But now we are moving to Hugo. How many of you have seen Hugo? Not very many. Okay. Hugo. Hugo is an extravagant, elegant fantasy with an innocence lacking in many modern kid movies, and one that emanates an unabashed love for the magic of cinema, directed by Martin Scorsese. Based on Brian Selznick's award-winning bestseller, Hugo is the astonishing adventure of a wily and resourceful boy whose quest to unlock a secret left to him by his father will transform Hugo and those around him and reveal a safe and loving place he can call home. Jeffrey Overstreet, Hugo.
And it's based on a very unique novel that has won all kinds of awards by Brian Selznick, which if you're trying to read this story to your kids at bedtime, your kids are going to have to be sitting up with the light on because you'll read several pages of text, and then the story continues in quite a few pages of illustrations with no text, and then back to the text again. And so it was already kind of a storyboard waiting to happen, and a storyboard that worships or just pays tribute to the craft of early silent films, again. So very timely movie. It's Martin Scorsese's true love, you know, the restoration, the salvation of these old films.
Yeah.
And so he gets to tell a story that's all about that when that's what he does, and, you know, with a lot of his blood, sweat, and tears. I guess if I have any complaints about Hugo, it's that if you hadn't told me Martin Scorsese had made the film, it looks a lot like things Robert Zemeckis has done, Steven Spielberg has done, Jean-Pierre Jeunet has done, and it's that kind of just overwhelmingly sumptuous view of Paris. But the characters were so winning that I stayed with it. And when I realized, you know, where this was all going and how... What Martin Scorsese is doing with 3D in this film is trying to create in us the same feeling of novelty and, wow, this is something very new. That train is diving right into the theater, right into my lap, practically. He's paying tribute right there to something that really happened in silent cinema when crowds, you know, ran screaming for the doors when they saw a train coming on the big screen. So the movie really, its form fulfills its function, which you don't see very often at the cinema, and it reminds us that cinema is really about moving pictures, not about photographs of people talking.
Sure.
So I really appreciate that.
And how do you feel like this movie is hitting the culture right now? What is it saying?
Well,
to us about ourselves.
Well, I went to the film with three real children. I went with my own daughters, right? And
in
so the actual demographic, who, by the way, are literalists and fundamentalists. I mean, they devoured the books, okay? They devoured, you know, Hugo Cabret. And so there was a lot of chatter in the car on the way home about how unfaithful the movie was to the book, right? So they're on me page and verse,
yes.
You know, about this wasn't developed here. So it was quite an animated, you know, no pun intended, drive home as we went through that. I think a couple of things with Hugo for me. I mean, I love the film. It was a wonderful adventure for us to sit through with my daughters and watch them just kind of being in awe of it and watching. And they love watching these things come to life. I thought the child actor who played the lead was a gorgeous child. I mean, he was absolutely
really?
Beautiful.
Seriously.
Spellbinding to see him.
Asa Butterfield.
And it was you know, a lot of it was really interesting to see Baron Sacha Cohen, the Borat character actually playing kind of an interesting like sympathy character. I was very very restrained for him. So all of that is good. I think a couple of things culturally with Hugo that I think was interesting. One is Jeffrey mentioned this really, which is a bit of hagiography or a bit of like past that's been accepted as truth, which is that when George Millet, who is the, you know, the main story behind the story, is he's this great filmmaker who's been reduced to selling toys, that during the era of silent, that when the first silent movie came, that there was a train coming, people weren't running for the doors and screaming. And it's actually been by many film scholars to be seen to be that never happened. But it's been accepted as gospel that's how transformative it was. And let me tell you that Martin Scorsese wants that to be true. He wants you to understand that films are the most important thing in your life. He wants to preserve them, and all the lines in the film over and over and again say that. Movies are where dreams happen. No, that's not true. Actually, when I go to sleep, I have dreams. You know, and so it's an incredible love affair, almost pornographically so, to what movies are. And so in that way, what it's done is, I think culturally, is it's slamming culture by saying, don't forget about movies, don't forget about movies, in an industry, by the way, that's in panic because we're not going to movies anymore. We're staying home and watching them on DVD and streaming. So the idea of the big watching thing is happening and changing. It's the same type of panic the church has been going through in itself, as people aren't going to churches, they're listening to podcasts about preachers. So the movie industry is going through the same thing that churches are going through with their own sense of self-identity. We don't gather like we used to. And so again, nostalgia, again, we're going to say not nostalgia. And by the way, the city that wins the Academy Award is going to be Paris,
as we're going to see. Definitely.
Because Paris is really big this year, okay? Yeah. So I mean, those are some things
which
I think.
Which I have no problem with. Come on. Yeah. Give me a question.
But I love the movie. It was beautiful, and it was an idealized picture of Paris, and I like the idea many ways better than Paris itself.
So another movie about a little boy who loses a father and has something left to him by his father is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. How many have seen this? Okay.
Un poquito.
One person in the audience says it. Oh, two people, including Chris and myself.
Yes.
Okay. This is the story of Oscar, who is convinced that his father, who died in the 9/11 attacks... and the World Trade Center has left a final message for him hidden somewhere in the city. Feeling disconnected from his grieving mother and driven by a relentlessly active mind, Oscar begins searching New York City for the lock that fits a mysterious key found in his father's closet. His journey through the five boroughs takes him beyond his own loss to a greater understanding of the observable world around him.
Yes.
Here's
my thinking about that, especially in relationship to Hugo, which I did not love, unlike these two gentlemen. Partly because, in some ways, Hugo was off center. It's allegedly about this little boy, but it was a hagiography about Méliès and about films. And so the boy, who is sort of the, you know, Dickensian abandoned orphan in the train station, is sort of like, kid, make the filmmaker happy. And Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which got such odd reviews and has been really mixed in its response, is profoundly centered, even unsettlingly centered, 2 hours in the sensibility of a child on the autistic spectrum, perhaps with Asperger's. So what's slightly uncomfortable but really fascinating about that film is it is 100% the child's perspective about the worst day. And so it's really not a cheesy September 11th exploitation film. It's an interestingly uncomfortable and yet ultimately, I think, quite redemptive story about how loved this odd and intelligent boy is and the ways in which he has to encounter, break through the grief of that experience and realize that all along his mother has been caring for him and all along there are broken relationships related to the Holocaust and his grandparents that kind of come together, and all the strangers that he meets on his sort of odd quest to find what the key fits, he ends up becoming a kind of healing figure in several lives. So it's very, very much the opposite of Hugo. If only we think about the brokenness of a child and the need for love and redemption. It's not as successful of a film. It's harder to watch. It's not as, you know, sort of brilliant. But to me, what bothered me about Hugo was the narcissism of the filmmaker, i.e. Scorsese. And what is lovely about this Daldry film is that it's always about this broken boy.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you as well. And if you want to see Sandra Bullock actually act, don't see The Blind Side. Maybe see this film. She does an incredibly good job in this as well. And I too went in sort of not wanting to see it because the reviews were so horrible and, oh, this is about 9/11. It really wasn't a film about 9/11 in the same way Titanic was not a movie about the boat sinking. It was about this love story. And I think the critics are reacting to that saying, wait a minute, you're taking 9/11, this huge story of our country, and sort of using it as, you know, a catalyst for the rest of your movie. And of course, it's based on a New York Times bestseller, a literary fiction book as well. But I agree with you, too. It was hard. There was that hard edge to the little boy that you, at one point, when he says to his mother, basically, I wish you would have died, you're like, you are like smack across the face, little boy. Like, this woman is trying to hold it together for you, and I can't believe you just said that to her, you know? And yet you have sympathy for him as he's going on this quest and trying to desperately connect and move through grief. It's an incredible movie of trying to move through grief with a child's eyes,
right,
which is uncommon, I think.
And just to build on that scene, as you and I both know, with the kid on Asperger's or the autistic spectrum, I mean, he has to say the truth, but then he struggles with his love for his mother and her grief and says, I didn't mean that.
Yeah.
In the way that he knows socially he's trying to repair the relationship.
Yes.
And she very kind of blankly but also very wisely looked at him and said, yes, you did. Yeah. And then, I wish it was me too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really poignant, really a key moment.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was beautifully done there. Okay, we've got to move on, keeping it rolling, to Hawaii.
Yay!
Do we need some sun here, Seattle? Yes, we do, in the form of a depressing film about a lady who dies in a coma, The Descendants.
We go from September 11th to the coma.
Exactly.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Hey, can I just sort of, one, I guess got to throw this one thing in here about September 11th, right? So,
okay.
I mean, so my question about this, and we can either take it or leave it, but it, will we ever be able to make a film that is a family drama about 9/11 in the same way that the question of many Jewish scholars say we should never make a film about the Holocaust? Because for many Americans, 9/11 is the most sacred thing that ever happened to this country, by which it was the greatest violation of all these other kind of things. And so it reigns supreme as an iconic open wound.
Yeah.
Right, and I don't know. I mean, so I'm wondering if this is what the critical backlash is about. If you could have done the entire movie without 9/11, if the father had just died in a car accident, you know, could you have had the same movie without the backlash? I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I just want to throw that out there.
You probably could have, but I think, you know, in a couple generations, people probably will be making movies about 9/11. There'll be mattress sales, and it's depressing. I don't mean to be trite, but I think that's what we've done to tragedy. And honoring of people like, oh, we honor Martin Luther King by buying a mattress. I mean, come on, right?
Yeah,
after some generations have passed, I think we might. Anyhow, I'm going to get emails for that. The Descendants!
Okay.
Okay, it is depressing, but you get to stare at George Clooney for 2 hours, so that makes up for it.
Right.
From Alexander Payne, the creator of the Oscar-winning Sideways and set in Hawaii, The Descendants is a sometimes humorous, sometimes tragic journey for Matt King, an indifferent husband and a father of two girls who is forced to examine his past and embrace his future when his wife suffers a boating accident off of Waikiki. The event leads to a rapprochement with his young daughters while Matt wrestles with a decision to sell a family's land handed down from Hawaiian royalty and missionaries. Funny, moving, and beautifully acted, The Descendants captures the predictable messiness of life with eloquence and uncommon grace. Again, all of these are from Rotten Tomatoes. These are not my editorial opinions on them. The Descendants. Dr. Cheney, we are starting.
Am I doing The Descendants?
We are actually starting with you on that.
I'm getting sick of my own voice. Well, here it is amazing. The Descendants. I found it fascinating. And maybe I'm on the Hollow Man kick here today. I think I am with The Descendants and the excuse me, I'm
did
the
you
artist.
Call George Clooney a hollow man?
I did call him a hollow man.
Okay, there we go.
You know, because what I decided when I was thinking about it was, I'm just going to move right on past that, Dr. Case, is that usually these sort of cuckolding stories usually end up being about the sexual prowess of the man who's been cuckolded and no, and you know, it's all this sort of massive angst around the quite literal, in literary terms, unmanning of this character, this Matt King. Mm-hmm. But to me, I think what's profound about The Descendants is that it's the making of him as a man. It reminds him of the fact that he had abandoned his role as husband and certainly father.
Yeah.
This tragic loss and the sort of shame that came with his wife's infidelity galvanizes him, shocks him into a restored place as the patriarch, quite literally, of the whole clan with this land sale at the end. And I think in some ways that's a really interesting take on sort of the cuckold tale or the, you know, the patriarch, is that it reminds him that he failed his wife and that actually he really did love her and he was really the one who loved her, not this sort of an affair guy. So he failed her, and he kind of forgives her at the deathbed scene, but he needs to still be alive for his daughters and for these two budding young women. And I think that the kind of restoration of himself as the father in this small kind of kitchen sink drama it has a more profound sense about being a man, you know, sort of manhood, which I think for both the artist and the Descendants is, I think, a question that's being asked.
I agree with all that. I mean, it's based on a novel, and I got the feeling watching the movie that it's probably a very good novel. I don't understand why it's nominated for Best Picture. I mean, there's not a single image in the movie that sticks with me. It's all in the dialogue. Yes. And, okay, so you've got this great story about his wife in the coma and him having to deal with what he's learned about her and having to learn how to be a better parent, having to learn how to be a better husband after the fact. Mm-hmm. He's also carrying this larger story that the movie begins with, this pictures of the ancestors, not the descendants, the people who lived on the land and who were devoted to the land and made the land, you know, fruitful. Is this... very emotional story about this family really going to come down to him slamming the obvious money-grubbing relatives and friends and going, you know, tragically, you know, or heroically, one way or the other, going from being very, very well off to almost being rich to valiantly choosing to still be very, very well off. So it's sort of a movie about the 2% and choosing to be in the 98,
there you go.
Not the 99. And so... I felt for him and for the story, but as soon as I walked away, the movie just kind of dissolved for me, or evaporated for me, as being a very nice story. But I really think the Oscar has a lot to do with looking at George Clooney.
Yes.
Whether you like
that or not. That's fine. With that, dreams of George Clooney dancing in our head, we will be back for more of the Kindling's Muse here at ALZ's Brewing Pub. Slider key is hot tonight, so it doesn't have to go very far to be very loud. Okay, welcome back to the Kindling's Muse. I am your host, Jenny Spohr, and we're whipping through the Oscars. Let's continue to whip.
Let's whip the Oscars.
Whip them good. Okay. We are now on to Moneyball. Isn't that what we decided?
We did.
Yes,
we had
I think
a little,
so.
You know. Chat. Okay, so we're going to Moneyball. How many of you have seen Moneyball?
Woohoo!
Oh, everybody.
Popular. It's on Netflix.
So y'all want to see Brad Pitt instead of George Clooney? Is that what's going on here? Come on now. Okay, I'll stop talking about the boy toys. All right, here we go. Although, speaking of boy toys, Jeff Q, you're up. Based on a true story, Brad Pitt stars as Billy Bean, the general manager of the Oakland A's, who has an epiphany. All of baseball's conventional wisdom is wrong. Amen. Forced to reinvent his team on a tight budget, Bean will have to outsmart the richer clubs, the one-time jock teams with the Ivy League grad Peter Brand in an unlikely partnership, recruiting bargain players that the scouts call flawed, but all of whom have an ability to what? Get on base, score runs, and win games. It's more than baseball. It's a revolution.
Wow, there you go.
For Rotten Tomatoes, to quote the Beatles, let's go, Dr. Cuse.
I love Moneyball, actually, and not just because America is the only, I mean America, because baseball is the true American sport, which I believe, and everything else is a parody of that sport. But I thought that the movie worked on a number of different levels that I thought was actually creative. And one of the main things that it did is it really lifted up, which I think is great, is that number geeks get their day in the sun. that finally we have a movie that says people who are into numbers and stats can be celebrated as heroes. And the Peter Brand character, by the way, Jonah Hill is nominated for a Best Supporting Actor. And I thought he was great in his role. Absolutely fantastic. The strengths of the movie for me that I thought really worked was, on one level, it was a slow burner of a film. It really kind of sat in not just the business of baseball, but the business of being, what does it mean to gather a group of people together without preconceived notions. I mean, baseball has been done the same way for years, kind of going after kind of these particular celebrity players or marquee players, and they wanted to really change the game. And I thought that in itself, is speaking of kind of, you know, movies that are commentaries on America right now, was like, how do we do the game of being a country or a culture differently? And it was a movie that kind of did that. And numbers have also been a very big part of what it means to be people of faith, whether it's in the Kabbalah and Gadamaria and this whole idea of reading the Hebrew scriptures by using each different letter to designate particular numbers, adding up to different things to get to the mystical meaning of God, the 72 names of God that you have and whatnot, to the way that which in the medieval period we layered verses on top of scripture, therefore making it a scientific document. By therefore we quote verses, add up verses around each other, and therefore it becomes scientifically viable, therefore, to read the scriptures because of that. The numbers aspect of this thing made the game come a spiritual alive kind of thing. If you trust in the numbers, the truth will happen. And so it's all about faith in the data. And I thought that was a really interesting kind of play out there. And so I thought the interactions were really great. I thought that I actually thought that Brad Pitt's performance for being Brad Pitt, and I say that with scare quotes for those who can't see on the podcast, was great. He did a good job in his role. So anyway, I'm a fan of Moneyball.
And faith in the data, faith in the numbers. I mean, that's what our culture is about. That's culture, right. Commentary.
Yeah.
But the one thing that you don't mention that
my stuff there.
Yeah. So. Well, you know. Yeah. And speaking as someone who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, I'm not just saying Oakland A's won the championship 3 years in a row when I was in elementary school.
There we go.
Okay. San Francisco Giants.
Props to the Giants, please. Thank you.
Giants won the World Series last year, I'm just saying. But the point of it is that really the revolution doesn't happen because they want to. I know, let's fix baseball. It's because the Yankees have more money than everyone else. The Yankees are, it's, you know...
They're the
1%. Exactly. And it's what it has, I think, again, I'm always looking at that cultural narrative of you can't win. They have loaded, the game is loaded in favor of the Yankees, the 1%. So you only change it because it's survive. You have to survive. I mean, we're a small market team in that horrible Oakland Coliseum, and we have an owner who doesn't have that money. And so you make it work, you survive. And I think one of the American narratives, besides the British, did have cricket before baseball, I hate to inform you, is that, right, it's that we have to. So how do you get innovative? How do you get crazy and survive because you have to? And that's that sort of scrappy American tale.
There's two other ways in which the movie sort of touches on something sacred, I think, too, and that's why it just really has the audience in the palm of its hand. One is its use of silence. You brought up silence earlier. Mm-hmm. When we watch sports movies, we know what's going to happen when the big victory happens at the end. The movie is going to be loud. The music is going to be blaring. It's going to be like the end of American Idol. The end of this movie, the victory happened in a much more mysterious place, in one man's decision, and the film quiets down at the big moment. And we are watching a man in a dark corner in a room, not even at the game, you know, absorbing this moment in silence. And the other sort of touch on the sacred is that what gets him through it is his relationship with his daughter.
Right.
Which, there's so much heart in this movie because of the screenwriter, Aaron Sorkin,
yes,
who also turned a movie about Facebook into something interesting.
Yeah. Right.
He turns this movie into something interesting because the way he got through the business of what he does and recovered from all of his famous addiction story was the role of his daughter in his life. And so, you know, when he looked at this script, that's got to be where he went, was the relationship between father and daughter, which pulls you through it. And that's clearly where his priorities are. And that really is what won me over as somebody who, I admire baseball, but I don't follow it religiously. Yeah. But this movie was very much about baseball and yet was also about the whole person. So
on to a movie that's about more than just what it's about. Aren't they all, though, I suppose?
Oh, yeah.
Lame segue. Wah, wah. Okay, War Horse.
War Horse.
Well, I've been invited to an Oscar party, and the theme is, there's always a theme every year, you have to create a dish based on the movie. And so I was the first to reply, so I picked Midnight in Paris and The Artist. So, like, easy, right? Come on, easy. I'm doing cocktails and dessert. I got it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I am worried about War Horse. War Horse, bring in the dish for War Horse. I'm not trying that. Anyhow.
Timothy Hay, maybe. I don't
know. Yeah. Yikes. Okay, so set against the sweeping canvas of Europe during the First World War, War Horse is a about a remarkable friendship between a horse named Joey and a young man called Albert, who tames and trains him. When they are forcibly parted, the film follows an extraordinary journey of the horse as he moves through the war, changing and inspiring the lives of all those he meets. Technically superb, proudly sentimental, and unabashedly old-fashioned, War Horse is an emotional drama that tugs at the heartstrings with Spielberg's customary flair, Jeffrey Overstreet, and lightness.
Well, I grew up with Spielberg movies and loved him growing up. And then I don't know if it was Spielberg becoming more sentimental as he got older, or me growing up and starting to notice that kind of thing, or maybe both. But I kind of burned out on him, and now I approach his films with a little bit of dread, because I know John Williams is going to push those buttons. I know he's going to zoom slowly in on somebody's face as their eyes get bigger and filled with tears. And when I heard it was about another war movie from Spielberg, for one thing, I was just... and about an animal suffering. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I was scared of this movie and really didn't want to see it. I'd read words like torpid, lachrymose, buttery, a piece of hopelessly middle-of-the-road entertainment and artificial uplift, and I thought, that's exactly what I'm expecting. But I kind of talked myself out of it watching it, because, first of all, there are amazing images in this film. And they're not just amazing images. They're images that are about something. It's set in World War I. Not a lot of great World War I movies. But he's telling the story of the war with the horse, not just as an animal you're going to care about, but as an agent that exposes the hearts and minds and personalities of people on both sides of the war. So it's no longer about us versus them. It's about each individual character and how they respond to this animal or nature or something beautiful is who they are. And, you know, Greg Wolf has a book this year called Beauty Will Save the World. He gets that phrase from lots of other wonderful places. But that's the theme of this film. And if you've seen a film called A Midnight Clear, or a film called Joyeux Noël, which is about a famous Christmas Eve truce between the two sides of the war, this film takes that story as inspiration and brings the horse into it and becomes one of the most visually beautiful portrayals of how beauty can save the world and become a reconciling agent that I've ever seen. And if it's a little sentimental, a little storybookish, a little childish, it's from a children's storybook, so maybe that's a little bit defensible. If people attacked The Black Stallion as sentimental, I would have a problem with that, because it's a book for kids. And so I think War Horse can be defended on all the fronts it's being attacked. And I wish I could just list for you the images that blow my mind in this film. But it's not hopelessly sentimental, because horrible, maybe more horrible things happen in this film than in Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. When you think about it, major characters do not survive. Hopes are dashed right and left. So I can forgive it as a somewhat happy, whimsical ending because of all of the things that we've lost along the way.
Okay, right. So whole box of tissue movie.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Yeah. And echoing what Jeff said, I totally agreed, expected something sort of cheesy. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful. I mean, just to visually, John Ford kind of film. But I wanted to say, it's like Dickens. It's like Charles Dickens, in that you know that sentimentality is coming from like a mile away, Tiny Tim, you know, hello, little Emily, whatever. And you go, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And yet, here it comes. Oh, no. Ah. And you completely succumb to the power. It's authentic emotion. And we're so ironic or skeptical or like, you know. But it's absolutely absolutely authentic emotion in the service of a kind of powerful story that's anti-war. That's the meaningless loss of life. Yeah. But it's sentimentality like, yeah, yeah, so what? It's almost beside the point, because it's so powerfully emotionally true. And in the service, like Dickens, of a kind of societal point that we all need to really think about.
And the bad kind of sentimentality is asking you to feel something that the movie hasn't earned.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this movie earns it.
Absolutely.
So. Well, and I've, you know, growing up, I always, westerns and war movies, I always cared more about the horses anyway. So this is finally a movie that's actually about
the horse.
And there's
horse best friends in it. There's horse best friends in it.
Oh, no.
Joey has a best friend horse who's a black stallion.
So, oh, no. Oh, no. It's a black stallion.
In the book, the horse actually understands English, French, and German.
Yes.
So this is actually quite a way removed from the anthropomorphizing.
Of course. Exactly. It's obviously not a patriot. Okay. I will go ahead and see that movie when I'm feeling too happy someday.
Right.
Moving on to The Help. How many have seen The Help? Okay, how many have read The Help? Okay. So that's a bit of a distinction. Let's talk about The Help. The Help shows three very different extraordinary women in Mississippi during the 1960s who build an unlikely friendship around a secret writing project that breaks societal rules and puts them all at risk. From their improbable alliance, a remarkable sisterhood emerges, instilling all of them with the courage to transcend the lines that define them and the realization that sometimes those lines are made to be crossed, even if it means bringing everyone in town face-to-face with changing times and disgusting pie. That was my own editorial comment. Though arguably guilty of glossing over its racial themes, The Help rises on the strength of its cast, particularly Viola Davis, whose performance is powerful enough to carry the film on its own.
And yes. So,
Dr. Cheney.
Thank you. Yeah, and you know, Jeffrey Overstreet just said some great wisdom from War Horse that I will use to segue to The Help, and that is sentimentality that doesn't earn it. It's deep. It doesn't earn its emotional deeper point, and that is maybe the fundamental, one of the fundamental problems with The Help. I actually think this is an appalling film. So I'm going to have some strong opinions about it. I think it's borderline.
People are
it's
like, I'm
borderline.
Sad. I'm going to throw fries at you.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm going to be a very strong speaker against a film I think is almost immoral.
Ooh.
Here's why. It takes the deep, deep racial brokenness that remains in our country and makes a glib, sentimental story about a young girl learning to find herself and her mean frenemy sorority girls, and that the African-American people do not risk their lives. Medgar Evers gets killed in the middle of it, and it's kind of barely a background. And the reality, having spent a lot of time in Jackson, Mississippi, and knowing that only a few years ago a white church was doing a Habitat for Humanity down from John Perkins' ministry, and not only never interacted with anyone in the Perkins ministry, but they hired armed security guards in the Jackson neighborhood they were working while they were building houses for the poor black folk. And so the other problem is that this is over and that it belongs in the Mad Men era and that we all just get along, and that the Viola Davis character can just walk down the road safely after being fired by this deeply, who's actually, the villainous Jessica Chastain character is the most accurate racist in the whole book.
Bryce Dallas Howard.
I'm sorry, yeah. But just that whole, the idea that somehow everyone is progressive, and it was written by a white Southern woman who wants to think of herself as that really I knew better, just sort of because I knew better. And I wish that was the truth. To me, it's a fairy tale of we wish this is how things are, but it isn't. And because it glosses over that reality, I find it really troubling. Mm-hmm.
And the racists in the film are portrayed as Stepford wife cartoon evil, so that from the beginning we hate them and want them to be humiliated. And that easily, conveniently steers us around actually having to think about what was going on, that racists have to slowly come to terms with what they've been doing, that this is about an awakening that needs to happen in us, in the ways that we are hard-hearted. And the movie just paints a target on all the hard-hearted characters from the beginning, so we will... Can you believe how much time this movie spends on the whole episode with the crap pie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to build
that's
up.
That's not figurative, by the way.
No, that's literal. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that one of the maids serves this pie to her racist employer, and
former employer. Yeah.
And so much time and attention is given to that just to build the suspense, so we will cheer and laugh when that villain is
disgraced. And feel great about ourselves.
Right. I love the way one critic put it. This movie is, at best, a wish fulfillment fantasy for everyone who insists they could never have gone along with the deeply institutionalized racism of the South. But it does that on every other political issue, too. You can see this right up front. As soon as you see a character smoking in this film, someone says, someday they're going to discover that that'll kill you.
Exactly.
Like, give me a break.
No.
The first time you see a homosexual character, somebody makes a joke about a cure. So it's all so, we're so enlightened now.
Yes, Marta, please bring us the drinks.
So it's about, so it's about as subtle as an episode of
Scotch
Desperate
has shown
Housewives.
Up on our table.
It really, that's it, Desperate Housewives. Yeah.
Well, it, you know, it's interesting. Probably the book has similar comments against it, but I would say, just defending the book, having read the book a little bit, that it is much deeper than the film, and you do see a little bit more of these characters. And actually, I think the book starts out with Abilene and the little girl that she nannies for. And that's just sort of this heartbreaking relationship that this little girl loves her nanny more than her mother.
Well, there are meaningful things in it. There are great performances in it. And Viola Davis wins, you know, she's a great actress.
Yeah.
But I got to read another critic's quote before we move on. If you were to come to me and say that you felt the writing in this film was not balanced, you didn't feel there were a lot of colors to the characters, their humanity was not explored, that these are all just blank, flat, unrealistic stereotypes, I would agree with you. I think that's a fair criticism. Viola Davis.
Exactly.
The lead actress of the film.
Right.
Dr. Hughes, what do you have to say about the help? Help us with the help.
Defend it.
Yeah, yes, wow.
Everybody in here loved it, apparently.
Yeah. It's popular.
Well, okay, so let me put some other optics on it from another angle.
Okay.
So I absolutely agree. And matter of fact, you both Dr. Cheney and Jeff here both are part of a chorus of critiques on the film when it came out. It was really interesting that when the book came out, if you look at the trajectory of how it came out, it was lifted up and kind of praised quite a bit. There was a lot of kind of support for the book until a couple of black scholars, in particular J. Cameron Carter at Duke and a couple of others, started writing scathing reviews of this, saying the way that the story is being framed is very much caricature and stereotype. And then the film came out under that kind of wave, and it started up again. I think that's absolutely correct. I think there's stereotypes in this movie that are problematic. The parts that I was more brokenhearted about was that and this is the part that I think is not necessarily helping the help, but I think is an indictment on America, indictment on the movie industry, indictment on those of us who consume this and not critically think about it. On the positive side, I thought what the movie really lifted up is that people don't raise their children anymore.
Mm.
And that has not changed at all.
Yeah.
For somebody who's a scholar who works on adolescent theory and development, the idea of the abandoned teenager, the abandoned youth who's raised by the institutions, we want to work hard to provide for our children, so we let somebody else raise them. I mean, the fact that you know, goes all the way back to this point is quite an indictment on the reality on so many levels. Everybody's raising everybody else's children, but there's never a parent with their own child. And so I was actually quite heartbroken by that, and I thought that is actually a very accurate question that needs to be raised for us today is how many of us just leave our children abandoned to bear the people to raise. And I thought that was kind of sad.
I'm hearing the echoing of my four-month-old screaming from Maple Leaf.
Yes.
Luckily, he's with his father.
That's
another parental unit.
That's right. So I think that was one side. The other side I thought that was very interesting in the commentary, and this is a part that I think was really, really interesting in both of the critiques that have been brought up, is that in the way that the movie trajectory went, that everybody in the movie was so polarized from each other that there was no sense of I don't know, reality between them at all. So that the Viola Davis character walking away, the Jessica Justine character, and it was so polarized from each other that there was no sense of any type of I don't know, complexity to the characters. And I thought, we don't like our characters complex.
Well, it came from a popular fiction book as well.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. I don't want to knock popular fiction because people...
No, it has its place.
Read it, right? Yeah. It has its place. Like,
I will say, this, as far as Academy Award for a movie that had the best automobiles in it, the Help. The Help unbelievable Dreamtime imported from Detroit. Yes. Okay. There are the most beautiful Cadillacs you're going to see.
Speaking of dream cars, though, we're moving on very quickly to Midnight in Paris.
That was my segue to you.
And there is a car that shows up.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very key in this movie. Midnight in Paris, it's Woody Allen. It's basically Owen Wilson playing Woody Allen in Paris and going back in time. Dr. Cuse, take it away.
Yep. So basically the premise of the movie is that you have this young man played by Owen Wilson, who is a stand-in for Woody Allen, because every Woody Allen movie has a stand-in for himself if he's not playing himself. Nervous, anxious, constantly self-deprecating, but supposedly the wise fool amongst a crowd of people overly certain. And Owen Wilson is supposed to be married to McAdams. What's her name?
Rachel McAdams,
right? And so one night while they're in Paris, as one does, he goes out for a stroll and mystically comes up upon it's like a bus or cab or something.
It's a Rolls Royce.
It's a Rolls Royce. That's right. He gets invited in, and of course you get in, right? Because you learn his children don't accept rides from strangers, but in Paris that's okay. So you get in a car and you get whisked away and you go back in time.
It's a wardrobe on wheels.
That's right. And you get whisked back in time to the golden era of Paris. This is the beginning of Shakespeare and Company. This is all the wonderful the displaced Americans who are showing up in Paris. So you have fights with famous painters. You have Ernest Hemingway sitting there in all of his wonderful purity, and the movie is about it's just kind of this really interesting kind of cadre of characters. So you have this back in time. You really do have a Back to the Future kind of moment. It goes back and do I stay in the past or do I go to the future? And I hated the movie. I really hated the film. I really did. There's two actors that I want to stop before they act again. One of them is Owen Wilson, and who I just basically despise on so many different levels. And the other is Tom Hanks, because he is one Oscar away from being the most winning best actor in the history of the Academy Awards. Yeah. So at least this year he's still off the table, but he will act again. But anyway, I just thought it was poorly acted. I thought it was caricatured. I thought it's gonna do violence to all the students I'm gonna come who are gonna think, oh, Ernest Hemingway said that, and so they're gonna be repeating the movie back to me, so I'm gonna have to undo that problem. So anyway, it made Paris look beautiful, like a big nice snow globe, and that was
Nice. Like, and now they know who Gertrude Stein is. Lottery macaroon is basically what it looks like. Yeah, okay. Big old raspberry macaroon
with a little misogyny thrown in.
Yeah, well, of course, that's gotta be.
You can refer your students to a fantastic review, though, by one of their fellow students, Lauren Wilford, who wrote a review for Filmwell that is fantastic.
Okay.
And it talks about how this Paris and these characters are our idealized versions of them very self-consciously. So if your students are coming away thinking they've just learned who Ernest Hemingway was, they weren't really paying attention to the movie. I mean, these are obviously fairy tale characters based on real people. And so again, it's about nostalgia, but it's not about losing yourself in nostalgia and valuing the past over the present. It's about, I mean, he learns the hard way there that nostalgia is what Bob Dylan said, nostalgia is death.
Right.
And that if you just stay there, you're stuck.
Right.
This is a movie that it loves when Paris was Paris. It loves when Woody Allen was Woody Allen. It loves when Owen Wilson was once funny. But it does finally give us some kind of sign that maybe there's some hope brewing in Woody Allen's storytelling. I mean, this is the most hopeful statement I've heard in a Woody Allen movie in years. The artist's job is not to succumb to despair, but to find an antidote for the emptiness of existence. Which is still pretty awful, actually, now that I think about it. But at least there's something still, some kind of joy to be had, and something more than mere self-indulgence. And so he is starting over at the end because he's learned to turn away from foolish idealization of the past and from a relationship that he really had idealized and wasn't going anywhere. So
it's basically Manhattan in Paris.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And I know you all came to hear us talk about the Tree of Life because all of you saw that 8 times, but we actually did a podcast on that. So you can look up what we think about the Tree of Life in our archive. We'll be right back with your questions.
Brother, sister. I'll throw my drink now.
Yeah, me too. We loved it.
Jenny, I have seen it. I have seen it 8 times. It's not hyperbole.
Welcome back to the Kindling's Muse here at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. It is buzzing here in the pub tonight. All the Oscar buzz.
Oh, yeah.
What will Jeffrey Overstreet be wearing? That's what everybody wants to know.
On the red carpet. Who are you wearing?
On the red carpet. All right, Jim at Table Sticks, we are starting with you.
Yeah, I'm just any comments about what movies should have been nominated that weren't, and any comments about the whole Oscar process.
So we're gonna.
In general, you know, just some general comments about the whole Oscar process.
So we're gonna cover the ones that should have been nominated at the end, but talk about the process, the Oscar process, just in general. How do these even get to be the nominees?
Well, if you're nominated, then you're in the Academy. Most of the voters are actors, as I said earlier. I have a surprise, a somewhat cynical view of this. You know, it's the industry, but it's the industry mostly in Hollywood. And so what I've seen over the years is that the movies that are really remembered are movies that sometimes don't even really get talked about until a year or two after they've come out. I mean, 2001 A Space Odyssey, for example. You know, Oscar just, well, what's that? But on the other hand, you got to think about marketing. The films that get seen are the films that have money behind them, and the films that have money behind them are films that studios say we can sell. So you're seeing a lot of movies this year that are much more shallowly about things that came out over the last 10 years, in movies that were much better but weren't seen. And if you are reading the critics that go to the festivals around the world, the movies they got most excited about this year, with the exception of Tree of Life, are not even mentioned in the Oscars this year, because as much admiration as they got at the festivals, the studios had to say, well, we can't sell this to Americans. I mean, just look at what happened to Hugo, for example. Hugo got seen. Martin Scorsese made it. It's got Jude Law in it, even if only for a moment. It's about the movies. But just look what they did to the title of that movie to sell it. It's based on a book called The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Apparently, I am now supposed to be out of breath. It's such a long title. They shortened it to Hugo Cabret late in the process. And then right before it comes out, they're like, oh, Cabret sounds foreign. So they abbreviate it to just Hugo, which is the worst title for this movie, I think, because, I mean, what does it tell you? Absolutely nothing. So it's the same way on the larger scale about which films get picked up for distribution. The films that I'm reading about that came out of the Cannes Film Festival, Juliette Binoche won Best Actress for my favorite movie of this last year at the Cannes Film Festival. But the movie does not have a distributor in the U.S. to this day. I mean, a year and a half later. It's one of her greatest performances. The only way I could see it was to buy a Blu-ray through Amazon UK. And it's by far the best film I saw. My favorite film I saw this year. I've seen it like 10 times. It's called Certified Copy. I'll say a little more about it later. But that's my, you know, the Academy goes for what's trendy, what's popular, the kind of politics that it's very righteous to be excited about right now, and to people who probably deserved it for previous films and their time has finally come. Christopher Plummer.
Okay.
Max von Sydow.
Ruthie, Table 5.
I was wondering if you would comment on why you think a number of the films this year, not only in the Oscar, the nominees, spoke to what it means to truly be a man, in the sense of not necessarily the what we normally think of masculinity, but more in that quieter father figure, taking responsibility for the relationships in his life.
Yeah. I think it's a great question, because I have thought some about that, and I teach film and story and various things, is that if you look to me historically in the 20th century, in a lot of literature, and in the 19th century too, that troubled times tend to produce certain kinds of stories, and not that this is just a sort of formula, but I think that the troubled times that we've lived in and a real reconsideration of the United States' place in the world and issues of power, and you know, we kind of did a post-September 11th, you know, military reaction for whatever reason, and things have gone really bad, basically, ever in the past 10 years. And so I often think that questions, you know, that the because films are made by men, largely financed by men, you know, it tends to be men's stories, and the questions about what does that mean if there's diminished power or there's suffering or job loss or identity loss or you know, infidelity, sexual issues. I just think that we sometimes, I think it's interesting to me and maybe not surprising that in a time when we're kind of questioning and feeling, you know, slip or crisis or, you know, however political ways we might want to respond to that, that notion of, you know, that the male is sort of the central figure of the culture and the family and all those things. I'm not surprised that we're taking up questions of that or considering brokenness and loss and how does restoration or healing happen within kind of interesting ways, new ways, sort of some new answers, I think.
And you're getting stories now from a wave of storytellers who grew up after a generation of stories about pursuing happiness.
Right.
These storytellers are growing up under the parents who pursued happiness and forgot them. So right. that we got a little movie called The Submarine this year that was just merciless toward irresponsible parents.
Right.
But foremost of all, you have Wes Anderson, the voice of the child who wishes the adults would get it together and be the parents
exactly.
they're supposed to be.
Exactly.
Look at all of his movies about fathers who have pursued happiness and failed and finally come back around to realizing right. what family is
right.
about.
Yeah,
right.
Toni Morrison, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist who, you know, who wrote Beloved and whatnot, said that what animates her fiction is one key question, is what happened to the African-American male in America? And I think we can enlarge that in many ways. I mean, you think of The Help, for example. I mean, the absolute, you know, there's no strong African-American male characters in there at all.
Only an off-season, off-scene abusive husband.
Right. So, I mean, that's a commentary in that way, but I think this idea of the erasure of maleness and kind of the understanding of it. I mean, last year in the Atlantic Monthly, Hannah Rosen's very important article that came out was, you know, the disappearance of the American man. And on the end of the man was the title of the article. And it was basically, this is the first year in American history where there are more women in the workforce than men. On all spectrums of that. And so with that kind of title change, there's an awareness of that, but there's also an anxiety about it. So I think we're starting to see some of the art bubble up, the anxiety of not knowing how do we talk about maleness anymore.
But I think what's lovely is that a lot of these offer answers. There's ways forward. They don't just land in a kind of bleak, you know, loss or lack or kind of the abyss.
Unless you're a male horse,
we haven't mentioned Win-Win, which was a movie a lot like The Descendants. I think a much better
yes.
movie than The Descendants.
It was great.
About a father figure who feels powerless, who feels embarrassed, and who really has to humble himself and do the hard work of taking on a second job to support his family.
Right.
And it's a beautiful film
and very redemptive.
And, yeah.
So
yeah.
maybe it's not about so much the loss of maleness, or then more of a redefinition of what maleness is or can be. Than what it has been in the past.
Or yes. Yeah, and I reclaim, I'm very much the Wes Anderson generation. I mean, one of my critiques of Hugo is that it's not the child's job to save the parents. And my parents were those baby boomers, and I definitely resonate with those stories of what we're looking for is men, at least to me, the redemption that's being offered is men rightly choosing to love their families and to care and provide, even if it means humbling yourself, taking the second job in Win-Win, or, you know, kind of admitting that you're a failure and your wife cheated on you with the sleazy real estate agent, and still saying, but that doesn't unman, you know, the George Clooney character. What I love is that we're not sort of going, oh, the failed man, or the loss of working class male jobs in American economy. It's more, in this context, how do you reclaim, you know, you chased after materialism, you chased after power or whatever. That was sort of the wrongness of those masculine choices. What's redeemed is a return to those kind of healthy, loving, much more egalitarian love, but still that sort of loving center, which to me is a new answer to that. It's not this old either or.
And Bill, that leads to your question. Sorry to come on you, Jeff. Bill.
I was curious if you saw in The Descendants an underlying story about the irresponsible daughter abusing alcohol, throwing away her life, and slowly through the film, she becomes responsible older sister and a real help to her father. If you saw that, because to me, that was one of the things that really stood out kind of just below the surface of the main story.
Right. And that actress did a great job, didn't she, really portraying that? I have a quick thought, but Jeff, you too. I mean, I think that was the classic acting out, right? That's the classic teen who is, you know, the canary in the coal mine articulating the complete chaos her family has become, including her father's cluelessness about the behavior of the mother, and that she's the one who knows. And there's, again, nothing worse than you being the one having to tell your parents what they're supposed to know. Yeah. And so that rage and that abuse, it, you know, comes out of saying, you're supposed to be the one who knows this and takes care of this, not me. I'm the kid and the girl, and you're the father. And so I think we see her get better as he gets better, and they become allies.
In some ways, her arc is as a character is clearer, I think, even than the father's, because one of my frustrations with The Descendants is you get the feeling this is a story about a man's reformation, but we really don't get much of a sense of a reformation from what. I mean, we get some vague sense he wasn't very tuned into what was going on with his wife. Vague sense maybe he was too busy with work, but that's never really defined. Right. Never enough that we might actually for a moment dislike George Clooney. That's very important. But she, we really see her growing up, and that really is a beautiful part of that film. There's a real danger right now with young people that when they see all of this irresponsibility in the adult world, they want to react with cynicism and anger. Stop. And that's why I love Arcade Fire. We can start talking about music.
Yes.
Their album, The Suburbs, there's a great line addressed to the young people of today. Some things are pure and some things are right, but the kids are still standing with their arms folded tight. And he's challenging the kids. You got to get over this part. And what's the line?
How are you going to lift it?
How you
with your arms folded tight?
Yes, he says something about how it really is heavy.
Yeah,
how
are you, I know, lift it ain't it light. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lessons learned from Canada.
Yes. Oh, Canada. That leads us to Jonathan.
Hey, why no love for Midnight in Paris? The movie was made as an indictment on the grass is always greener mentality, and it succeeded marvelously. So what could have, should have been done to make it better?
Well, for the record, I liked Midnight in Paris.
So did I.
There we go.
See, it's this team against that team.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it's really
10 points away from Gryffindor, Jeff Hughes.
Do you want me to respond to that? Well, I guess a couple of things. One is that if we measure the success of something financially about whether it's a good piece of art, then we're in danger, right? So that means that Taylor Swift may be one of the best things we've ever created. And then also people are like, why are you picking on Taylor Swift? Okay, fine. Yes, it was...
show. Save here, that
okay,
for the music
show.
So
I'll take the gloves off. Okay, here's the thing for Midnight in Paris, all right? Woody Allen knows better than to make a movie that is that easy and that categorically simple for us to understand. What he did is he created the semblance of an art house movie for people who don't want to work at an art house movie. To go to an art house movie to watch it and said, I saw a movie about Ernest Hemingway,
Gertrude Stein.
One's wonderful artists and
F.
everything
Scott
like that.
Fitzgerald.
Yes, all these people. So I got to do that so I don't have to read their books or think about what they did, right? So therefore I can go to my dinner parties and things like that and talk about it with some semblance of actually engaging real art. And Woody Allen knows this, and he knows America is not willing to do the heavy lifting of what it is to engage these artists, and he sold it to us and we bought it in droves, and we talk about it at the mall, we talk about it in our minivans, and we love it. And I'm mad at Woody Allen because he's really, really smart, he's very articulate, and he also knows how to finance his back pocket. And it's the most successful Woody Allen movie in history. And I think that's also a tragedy because he's an amazing artist.
He can be.
So now when...
Occasionally.
So when you look at the listing of best Woody Allen movies, now you're going to have Midnight in Paris topping the list. Yeah. And Annie Hall is way down here. And Manhattan is way down here.
And
that's a crime against society.
That is a crime and misdemeanor, if you will, Dr. Q.
I was feeling bad about what I said about The Help. Forget it, man. Totally passed me up.
We need to do a Woody Allen show.
We should. I just liked it because I can't say.
I just feel nervous about it.
I just liked it because it was like, I went to Paris. Here is what I did. Here, play the movie. You don't have to look at my photos. It was not. I was not trying to have a deep experience. I just wanted to see the Eiffel Tower and the the Arc de Triomphe and relive my 10-year anniversary.
Okay.
Anyhow.
Wow. Okay.
So we always end the show talking about what you wish was nominated. So we were going to go around and say what we wish was nominated for us. And then we're going to talk about what we think will actually win. So, Jeffrey Overstreet, we're starting with you. What do you think should have been up for Best Picture?
Well, Rent, Take Shelter, which comes out today, so you can see Michael Shannon's Best Actor Should Have Won performance. He's not even nominated, but Take Shelter. But that's not the movie I want to talk about. I mentioned Certified Copy, which is still not available in the U.S., except that it's now streaming on Netflix. So depending on how good your signal is there, if you can get a really good picture through that, then go ahead. It's by an Iranian exile filmmaker named Abbas Kiarostami, who is considered among filmmakers and critics around the world to be perhaps the best, greatest living filmmaker. He makes a film about a woman played by Juliette Binoche who loves art, who has emotional responses to art, who embraces a public art statue, and the man she loves, who is an art critic. She goes to his reading. They go on a drive across Italy together, this beautiful drive, and they talk about that. The fact that he looks at art critically from a distance and actually says, art is dangerous. You don't want to get too close to it. I don't keep art at home. I keep practical things at home until I'm done with them. And then you realize that this is how he treats people, too. She loves people. She loves him. She's uncritical. She embraces everything. And you can see that she's just full of scars because of it. The film is about how we live. It's sort of, are we going to live at a critical distance from things so we can be superior and the intellectual elite? Or are we going to embrace without discernment? The greatest moment in this film, and it'll be different for each of you, comes when you start to question, wait a minute, what is their relationship? Did they just meet? Is she just a fan? Or were they once together? Were they once married? Are they still married? The film will not answer that question for you, and I would argue it does not give you enough to make one final solution on that. But that question will tell you something about you. Do you want and long for the real thing, no matter all the damage that's going to come with it? Or do you prefer that this is just an intellectual exercise, because then we can stay at a distance and argue about it? And this film takes it as far as the door of the church. She walks into the church in a moment of temper tantrum. And he stands at the door with a piece of bread in his hand, undecided. And wine is very important to this film, too. I have no idea if this filmmaker is a believer, but this film is about the most important questions in our lives as parents, as artists, as moviegoers, as believers. I've seen it about 10 times. It makes me cry. But it would put most of my friends to sleep the first time, because you have to have that conversation afterwards to start taking it apart. It's a beautiful thing, and couldn't sell it. Americans don't need it.
Okay. So what... Oh, I know. what do you want to win of the 9 that are nominated? What will, in your opinion?
The artist is going to win. I, of course, would love to see The Tree of Life win. No doubt about it. Nothing else up there comes anywhere close for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doctor.
Well, so I'm with Jeffrey because apparently we're on the same team in terms of The Artist will win and The Tree of Life would be my choice. But I'm going to go so totally in a weird place on what I think should have been on the list. And this comes from the part of me that really thinks District 9 should have been the best the Academy Award winner in 2009.
Me too. Oh,
a couple years ago, yeah.
Because the film that I would put in here is Drive.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Not just Gosling.
Somebody is a Gosling fan.
It's not Gosling. It's that director Nicholas Vinding Refn, however you say that, a Danish, who also did that Valhalla movie. Mm-hmm. I have a husband who makes me watch these movies. But I find, like District 9 with Disturbing Violence, a sort of parable-like and allegorical, really powerful tale about, again, that sort of lone, cowboy figure who's also wants to come stand into the place of a failed father for this boy, and this and a kind of justice restoration, making everything right in the way that iconic, kind of Clint Eastwood character would have been, with this really interestingly disturbing violence in the way that director films violence and motion, contemporary Los Angeles with that, again, that kind of mythic, allegorical format. I just found it a really powerfully interesting film that was fairly commercial and had Ryan Gosling.
And he won Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival over Terrence Malick.
Yeah, so he did. It
was pretty amazing.
Okay, well, I think Ryan Gosling is like the new Justin Timberlake or something. Everybody's like crushing on him.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Or Benedict
former Mouseketeer.
He's
right.
Not, yeah. Not, he's right. Apparently a genius.
He's quite a nice gentleman.
Well, it's hard because I actually think that of what I saw this year, The Tree of Life was hands down the film, right? So you're asking what should win. I mean, and what I wish would be was that one. But I'm gonna go kind of totally off the grid with this one.
Go
of my thing that I think got overlooked, even though it is nominated for achievement in art direction. I think that I would love to see Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Be shown a little more love than it was. And the reason why I'm going to say this is that I think that in the same way that Peter Jackson got a serious amount of Academy love for the last of the Lord of the Rings trilogies, which I thought was the weakest of the three.
Yes. Yeah.
But he got an Oscar for it anyway because it was a culmination of this great journey. I think that you cannot underestimate the power of what Harry Potter has been to culture as far as what it's done on so many different levels, as far as getting a generation to read again, to sparking an imaginative spark that we... You know, God forbid, we wouldn't have Twilight without Harry Potter. We wouldn't have all these other things without Harry Potter. I mean, but I'm saying it re-energized the fantasy industry, Jeffrey Overstreet, that in one ways was dormant if not dead until that came into being. So I kind of wish that franchise got a big, huge embrace by the end, but that didn't happen. And one other overlooking that I think that needs to be thrown out there is I think that Andy Serkis should have been nominated for an Academy Award for his performance as Caesar the Monkey in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Because I think that one of the things that we have underestimated is how far stop motion has come and the way that, and his performance in that film, if you don't even like these kind of films and things like that, what he achieved is a believable character in that, was the embodiment of a character. I mean, there was a huge campaign trying to get him nominated, and that didn't happen.
Well, that happened with him for Lord of the Rings as well.
That's right. Yeah. And so maybe it'll change again, but I don't know. But I thought
I bet most Americans could not pick Andy Serkis out in a lineup if you saw him, unless you're somebody like me and watches everything BBC, then you probably could.
Yeah.
And that Alan Rickman can act, in Harry Potter.
And Downton Abbey was overlooked this year.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say what should have been nominated was Downton Abbey. Of course, that's television.
Yeah, that's right.
But who's obsessed with that? Yep. Me. It is an hour and a half, though. I mean, so it's almost like a full-length feature.
Only if you're watching the British versions. Americans get abbreviated. Each episode is abbreviated by about 20 minutes.
Oh. Right.
So that Laura Linney can talk about one.
So more people die by the Spanish flu, yes.
Exactly. There's more Spanish flu going around. Okay. Yeah, so I think Downton Abbey.
What about you?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Downton Abbey.
Okay.
I didn't get out to too much this year with a newborn and all, and also a 3-year-old movie going, and viewership is way down in the Spore household. But Tree of Life, I would say, too, for me, I think should win. For me, the Oscars, I like it to be an epic film. I like it to be a film that is great on so many levels, on the directing, the acting, the writing, the way it is shot, the lighting. I mean, everything. I want it to be done to a beautiful status, every single thing. So a movie like The Descendants, I just go, okay, it was acted pretty well, and that was a pretty good story, but, you know, the cinematography is pretty boring. There's nothing really that makes it stand out, that you just say that, you know, unlike last year, The King's Speech, I thought was beautiful. And yes, it was sort of the stock story, but the way it was shot, how it was acted, all of these things, I think, took it to an epic level for me. And that's why when I look at Tree of Life, it is far, blasts everything out of the water, far and away, that has been nominated this year.
Have you thought about what your first movie for your kids is going to be?
I have, you know, and my husband and I have just started to discuss that because our daughter is 3 and a half and she's getting to the movie stage. She's only watching little 8-minute, like, Kipper and Timmy Time. And thank you, Nick Park, for your animated claymation things. So she's watching that, and we're trying to think what is going to be not scary for her, because she's a pretty sensitive little kid. So
it's the new Winnie the Pooh. I would say the Oscars never pay attention to children's movies.
We're thinking maybe Winnie the Pooh or maybe Mary Poppins, because she loves music. She loves to sing, and she already knows half the songs from that anyway. Wow. So that might be.
I remember my first film.
What was your first film?
It was The Sound of Music.
Well, see, that's another one that might, but the Nazis would freak her out. That would be a long bedtime discussion. Who are they? You know, okay, anyhow. Thank you again, everyone, for hanging with us through the exciting slog that is the Academy Awards show here at the Kindling's Muse. We will be back next month with a show on grunge. It has been 20 years, people. 20 years.
Here we
Since
are
now. Pearl Jam and Nirvana topped the charts. Do you feel old? Yes, I do. But join us next month for that. Thanks. That is all.
Thank you.
Great job, Jimmy.